The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly Late Goal Special. When was the last time David Moyes danced? 3 in the last 10 minutes, enough for him to really let himself go at Spurs. A late one for Ross Barkley means Villa have 4 wins from 4. Manchester United score 3 after the 86th minute to make sure Bruce out trends again. Meanwhile, last minute goals rescue points for Brighton and Southampton. And of course, the late non-goal in the Merseyside derby. Where is the line? What's the other line? What are they pointing at? Are they straight? Will there ever be a line we can truly trust? 2-2, but the biggest story of the weekend, the injury to Virgil van Dijk. We'll assess the implications of that to the title race as the Premier League loses the only player who knows how to defend. All that, plus your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Andy Hunter, good morning.
Good morning.
How are you?
Very well, thank you. Not
excellent,
too bad.
Excellent news. Barry Glendenning, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you, Max.
Excellent news. I saw on social media you started a journey last night. You've asked for weight loss tips from the nation.
Oh yeah, well I tipped the scales at 17 stone yesterday for the first time in my life. And then I discovered that was down to a rogue bathroom floor tile, because when I moved the scales to the next one to the left, I was only 6. I sort of dropped 5 pounds immediately. So I just need a bigger bathroom, basically.
Congratulations. A pod debut for Natasha Henry. Hey, Natasha.
Hey.
I won't start with what do you weigh? It seems like a rude question to begin with. Some admin. Who do you support, please, Natasha?
I'm an Arsenal fan.
You're an Arsenal fan. Okay. Anyway, okay. Look, it was really hard to decide whether to start with the Merseyside derby or Spurs West Ham, but we probably need to give West Ham the joy of leading the pod. Peter says, David Moyes' celebratory jig is the best from a manager since David Pleat. Weird, hoppy, dancey, jumpy, joyful music. John Bruin tweeting, that Tottenham title challenge lasted from 4:46 p.m. on the 18th of October 2020 to 6:21 p.m. on the 18th of October 2020. And Matthew says, why do these things consistently happen to Tottenham? Is the club's DNA just too strong to overcome? And Lucas says, Barry, Spurs, go.
I was actually making my dinner when that Lanzini goal went in. Like everyone else, I assumed West Ham had been soundly beaten. Then they scored one. It was like, that's interesting. They scored the second. It was like, looked at the clock. It was, I think, 3 minutes left, and went, would be a fairy tale, but this isn't going to happen. And then not only did they score, but they scored one of the best goals I have ever seen in my life. And it was also a goal that was incredibly avoidable, but the release of energy on the sideline from David Moyes, on the pitch from Manuel Lanzini, from me in my kitchen, where, you know, I've no affiliation to West Ham whatsoever, but it really crowned, put the cherry on top of what was a long weekend for me watching various football matches.
From Squawker Football, Manuel Lanzini has had one shot in the Premier League this season. Based on expected goals, it had a 2% chance of going in. I presume, Natasha, with your Arsenal hat on, that was a joyous moment for you.
It was really funny. I went to Sheffield United Fulham yesterday. So I got on the train, still had a little bit of battery left, and Spurs were 3-0 up. By the time I got home, it was 3-3. And I was just like, what is going on? I mean, even though Spurs are Spursy and we all joke about it, I still did not expect West Ham to get anything. Lanzini's goal was amazing. I love the pylon. I mean, it was so old school playground football to see a bunch of players just leaping on top of each other. But yeah, it was wild. I think, you know, everyone's talking about Jose, and maybe you can't change the DNA of what players believe they should. Spurs have shown they can't see out a game too many times now. Maybe Bell will change that. You know, he's a winner, he's a champion. Maybe he'll come back and set a new standard.
He didn't change it. He didn't change it yesterday,
well,
did he?
No, well, we know it takes him 25 games to achieve anything at Spurs. So, you know, that takes us to near the end of the season.
I mean, that goal, Andy, we were talking about it before the pod, as Barry said, it was so avoidable. I mean, Arise Sajourie, but he doesn't need to, he could just lump it clear. Winks has a chance to lump it clear. From a Spurs point of view, I felt a bit sick, to be honest.
I'm sure you did. I didn't think it was a foul, I must admit. But saying that, I have to admit, when it got to 3-2, I thought I'd best pay attention to this because I can't miss West Ham's inevitable equaliser. And it was great to see Moyes. I liked how it was quite rusty, his dance at first, but then the more he got into it, the better it got. He seemed to be, you know, just limbering up a little bit. And then he should have carried on a bit longer. And the pile on as well, as Natasha says, great to see one of them, even in these times.
Obviously, there was a lot of people tweeting, I think even me, you know, about Moyes and should he be allowed into the ground? Should he do all the games on Zoom? By the end of the game, it was, you know, Moyes Stamboul for that. How much, Baz, how much credit do you give David Moyes and West Ham?
I think they deserve lots of credit. They got off to a hideously bad start. Tottenham's opener was almost a replica of one. It was the one they scored against Manchester United. You know, Kane playing the ball over the top for Son to chase. He cuts inside and curls it in inside the far post. Wonderful goal. They're 3-0 up inside 16 minutes. And if anything, Spurs fans can take consolation from the fact that in Son and Harry Kane, they have two of the best players in the Premier League, if not the best players in the Premier League. They're both in form and they are going to score loads and loads of goals. This was a bit of a freak outcome. Spurs fans will be sick at what happened in the last few minutes, but they should be very optimistic for the season ahead on the grounds of what happened in the first 15.
We spend a lot of time on this pod talking about how Chelsea can't defend and therefore Lampard is hopeless. But Natasha, Spurs can't defend either. Certainly set pieces are a problem for them.
Yeah, I think we've all known Jose as being a manager whose teams don't concede a lot of goals. I think a lot of people are ignoring how many goals Spurs are actually conceding, but their strength going forward. I've always said Son's the sort of player I would take him at Arsenal all day long. He's a grafter. He scores goals. He's really about the team. And watching his post-match interview yesterday, I actually felt really sorry for him. But their defense,
he almost cried, didn't he? He yeah. almost burst into tears.
It was very like Sunday League, you know, like, oh my God, I can't believe we did that. But that's good. That's what you want in your team. You want players to care that you lost. I think Lloris is great. I think he's been one of the better keepers this season, and we've seen quite, you know, with Kepa and Pickford, some disappointing performances. But I think the guys in front of him, they make him nervous. He doesn't seem to have confidence in them, and Jose needs to find a way to deal with that, because the way they're conceding goals is going to damage. If they have a title chance, then that's going to be the big issue for them.
I was going to say, you can't beat a good diving header, though.
I'm not sure what Davinson Sanchez was doing. Andy, what did you make of Gareth Bale? Wild Dingo says, Gareth Bale looked like he was about to collapse after his attempt at goal, maybe to help Barry feel better about his weight. Let him know that even if he looked like Bale, he'd still have a tough time. He did look slightly, apart from that move, and I don't know how he put it wide because his feet were beautiful. He did look, you know, there's nothing that can get you ready for match fitness, right?
Yeah, exactly. You could see that in the finish. But I thought he was, you know, on the short time that he was on, he was making the right runs as well. And he was kind of aware of, and Kane was aware of where he was going to be, which obviously, you know, bodes well for the future for Spurs, that already there's a hint of an understanding there, which can only improve. But yeah, once he did everything right, and it would have been the perfect Bale story with that goal. But it was the perfect West Ham story in the end.
Someone did tweet, we've bought on Bale, they've bought on Lanzini, crying emoji, which has been, that's done the rounds. I think Declan Rice retweeted it amongst others. Finally, Matthew says, I don't have a question, but at half time in the Spurs game, I got a knock on the door from a fireman who looked like Alan Pardew. This has to mean something. Perhaps it all stemmed from the Alan Pardew fireman who knocked on Matthew's door. And we will leave that game there. Everton 2, Liverpool 2. A lot of VAR, Andy, for you to deal with during this game. Richard says, since he was apparently offside, would Mane have been better off ignoring the ball and kung fu kicking Pickford, since apparently that is legal? That covers all the big VAR in one question. We should start with Virgil van Dijk, I think, because he requires surgery on an ACL. Liverpool will only know the length of his absence after the operation, which has not yet been scheduled. it'll be a long time out. Huge implications for the title race. He said on Twitter, in footballers in life, everything happens for a reason. And you can't with Van Dijk do these sort of Premier League comparisons with or without Van Dijk, because he's played all but one game since he signed for Liverpool. He is crucial to them.
Yeah, it's absolutely devastating loss for Liverpool. It's the worst possible thing that could have come out of the derby for them. I think it was funny, before the season started, we were doing our Guardian pre-season previews, which we changed this year. And it was like, you know, what can Liverpool not afford to do without this year? And I just put Virgil van Dijk, because he is indispensable to them. And the manner in which he's now, you know, let's be honest, probably going to miss the rest of the season, you know, or certainly the bulk of it, is just adds to the anger, I suppose, around Liverpool. It was an absolutely appalling challenge, and how Pickford wasn't sent off is still beyond me now. It was terrible, absolutely terrible.
What do they do? Is it Matip and Gomez is sort of what they have, right?
Yeah, or Fabinho. Fabinho can go in there. I think the problem you got now is obviously Lovren went in the summer, and they decided that they wouldn't replace him because they had the Fabinho option, and they've got a couple of young players coming through, but none of whom with any Premier League experience. But you've got Matip and Gomez, whose injury records aren't great. They're really stretched there now, and I think it was noticeable even before Van Dijk had, you know, had a scan or seen his consultant yesterday, that straight after the game, amid his anger, the one departure from Klopp away from all the controversies was to go on about how well Gomez had played. But, you know, he was bigging him up, how well he'd done against Calvert-Lewin, because I think he knew straight away that he was now relying on a player who, up to the Villa game, and, you know, obviously in the Villa game, has had a poor season. And now he's heavily, heavily reliant on him.
And Natasha, there's something so frustrating about VAR that it can spend so long looking at whether there's an offside in the, well, both for the goal that isn't given, but also in the build-up to that injury for Van Dijk. They're spending so long looking at those lines, and they don't seem to spot the assault that is happening like half a second later.
Yeah, I think the problem that definitely with fans, the frustration with VAR is no one really understands it. It's not necessarily VAR that's the problem. It's the rules that are the problem. Until, you know, Pickford should have been sent off. It was an awful tackle. I don't buy that he did it deliberately. I think it was reckless, and he's going through issues with his game right now. But yeah, VAR is, I don't want to say it's ruining the game, but I think the rules are allowing it to ruin the game.
It's not just supporters who are confused by VAR. The clubs are. The reason why Liverpool contacted the Premier League on Saturday night is because they'd had loads of conflicting explanations for how VAR was used in that game. And the clubs themselves don't know how and why VAR is being used. And the other thing as well, though, Michael Oliver should have seen Pickford's challenge all day long. He had a good view of it. And I do wonder now, is if, like, on big decisions like that, are referees automatically just, you know, thinking, well, VAR will bail me out on this one? Because he should have seen that, and he should have sent him off straight away.
Jordan Pickford's done this before. He did it against Dele Alli. And he, whether it's a reckless challenge or just sort of running out when he doesn't need to, he's a very curious goalkeeper. He made some brilliant saves in this game. He should have saved Henderson's last minute one that went in. It's almost like he shouldn't be a goalkeeper with his mentality.
He was brilliant at Sunderland, where he made his name in one of the worst teams ever to play in the Premier League. He was letting in 3 or 4 goals a game routinely, but still emerging as the man of the match. And this at an age where he wasn't even 20 years old. So I think that shows remarkable character. But somewhere along the way, it has all gone horribly wrong. And we saw every facet of Jordan Pickford in that game. Brilliant saves. A rush of blood to the head where he goes on some kamikaze expedition out of his goal. Clatters into Van Dijk. And then he let in a soft one. And if Henderson's had counted, he should have kept that one out as well. So, you know, you saw everything there is to see of Jordan Pickford there. But considering where he came from and how he made his name, and the strength of character he must have had, because that could have finished him when he was playing for that Sunderland team. You know, he could have just broken him mentally, as it would have possibly broken many other goalkeepers, and he could have sunk down the divisions and we'd never have heard of him again. But he came through it and became England's number one. So it's I don't know where it's all gone wrong for him, but it is going wrong.
Let's just cover off that last minute goal, Andy. I mean, I agree with Ian Wright on Match of the Day saying that's, you know, it's not what offside was brought in to do. We've said it before. We don't need to say a whole lot about it. I think any fan, apart from Everton fans, think that goal should be chalked off.
No, I think it, even amongst celebrating in the cold light of day, Everton fans would, you know, privately, quietly accept that it's a ridiculous decision. I mean, it's a sport. It's not science. You know what I mean? We shouldn't be using, as I say, trigonometry to decide the outcome of a Merseyside derby. It's ridiculous.
Mm. I always see the lines and I can't work out which line is, who's on which line and where they are. I just find the whole thing so frustrating. I should ask, Andy.
I do wonder whether VAR should now be used for like tight offside calls like that. Should we narrow the application of VAR to just, you know, red card offences? Because when Jonathan Moss, you know, the beginning of the season with the Walker Peters thing, overturned his decision. It was like, oh, the VAR's good now because he's using the pitch side monitor. And maybe it should be narrowed, its use, and we should, like, you know, scrap it for moments like that, because it's killing, I do think it is killing the enjoyment and the spectacle of the game.
So that means that Aston Villa are the only team with a 100% record. JSS says, my son is 20 days old, has never seen Aston Villa lose. Do I ban him from football forever? Terrible game for those who spent $14.95 on it. Terrible news for Jordan Jarrett Bryan, who wrote off Dean Smith. I would love Aston Villa to win every game this season just to hear him struggle. Ross Barkley's late strike. For the first time in 90 years, Villa win their first four league games. Great for Ross Barkley, terrible for Jordan Jarrett Bryan, Natasha.
I knew you were coming to me for that. It is great for Villa. I think the sign-in of Barkley is exactly what they need. It takes some of the pressure off Grealish, who, you know, has been their go-to guy last season. In Jordan's defence, I don't think many of us can sit here and say we expected Villa to start the season like this. If you did, then please give me the lottery numbers, because you must have a crystal ball that I don't have. I think the question is, though, as good as they've been at the start of the season, will they be able to take that over 38 games? You know, with the greatest of respect to Villa, I feel like there's at least realistically a good eight teams who will finish above them come the end of the season.
At the start of last season, Dean Smith barely had a team. He barely had 11 players. He had to buy a lot of players. So he bought a lot of players for sort of 10, 15, 20 million that didn't work out. So a lot of whom didn't work out, but he didn't really have any choice because it was that or not have a team to field. This season, he's gone about it in a completely different way because he had the option and has made some incredibly shrewd signings. So it's no surprise that they're improved. I don't think they will win the league, but I think there's every chance they'll comfortably finish mid-table or possibly in the top 10, which is where Aston Villa belong.
I do think that Villa is a good move for Barkley, as well as Barkley being a good signing for them. They're in the right place for him. It's a place where he can go and be a bit of a star. That was never going to happen at Chelsea for him. It just wasn't. It was the wrong move from day one. And at Everton, he had, you know, a lot of expectation on him as the hometown boy, probably carrying a poor team. And that got to him a bit. And I just think maybe Villa is the kind of the club, you know, a big club looking to push on, that is the perfect fit for him.
No Vardy for Leicester. Soyuncu out for a while as well. Brendan Rodgers said, we tried to be too precise, which is a bit like, you know, in job interviews saying, what's your big failing? And you say, I'm just a perfectionist. But look, it could have gone either way that game. It was pretty turgid, but well done, Ross Barkley. That'll do for part one. Part two will begin at Stamford Bridge. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Now, before we do Chelsea-Southampton, Barry, we've got another online Zoom live show, haven't we? Monday, the 9th of November. Me, you, Wilson and Barney. Sell it to the people.
Well, just listening to you list the names out, it sounds like it could be an evening of curmudgeonliness. But we will do our best. to entertain the masses. I'm looking forward to it, and hopefully lots of people will subscribe.
Absolutely. And if you if we need Wilson to do an eating challenge to make you buy a ticket, we absolutely will. We'll put out all the details later this afternoon. So find it on Barry's Twitter or my Twitter or Wilson's or Barney's if he can be bothered to retweet it. But yeah, Monday the 9th of November, I think it's a 7:45 kickoff. We'll do 45 minutes each way with a special halftime show as well, like the Super Bowl. We'll get Coldplay to perform or something like that. Come along, and thanks for in advance for getting a ticket. And if you don't get one, it's okay, we forgive you. Chelsea 3, Southampton 3, same old Chelsea, so good going forward, so bad going the other way. Southampton's second goal was my favourite moment of the weekend. Zouma's terrible back pass, Kepa just not bothering with the ball, and Che Adams eventually putting it home. Barry, I mean, it's difficult, isn't it? Because going forward, Werner was brilliant, and Havertz started to develop an understanding with Mount and with Chilwell. But if you can't defend, what's the point?
Well, I suppose the one thing I would say in mitigation is that goals conceded here were more down to poor individual errors rather than a collective shortcoming on the part of their defence, which tends to have been the case in previous games. That's not much of a consolation. If you have to score three or four goals every game just to get a point or three, that's going to be a problem no matter how good your attackers are, and this seems to be the case. I'm not sure why they can't organise a defence. They have good players, but it is a problem. And the individual errors killed them on Saturday.
Andy, Timo Werner's, that turn for the first goal was just glorious, wasn't it?
Both goals, I loved both goals. Just, it just looked so composed. Like, he was just having fun and ignored the fact that Southampton defenders are all around him and closing down. Just did what he wanted to do. He must be still wondering how he wasn't on the winning side on Saturday, but he already looks a class act.
Natasha, Barry and I were talking to Jonathan Wilson yesterday. He was saying basically Chelsea or Man United should just cut their losses and take Pochettino right now.
Yeah, for me, it's a race of who does Pochettino want to go to? I've never been convinced by Solskjaer. And as much as I like Lampard as a player, I just feel like I don't want him to ruin his legacy at the club. I think, which he could be in danger of doing if he doesn't win something this season. But one thing I want to say, Southampton, I don't think Ralph Hasenhüttl gets enough credit. I think from last season when they got battered 9-0, to get the players to believe in you, to keep the fans on board and to pull out results like a 3-3 against Chelsea, he's doing great work with a really small budget. I think he definitely deserves a round of applause.
And he's playing two centre forwards, a sort of big man, little man. I mean, they're both talented, Adams and Ings, aren't they? But it's nice to see that.
Yeah, and look how well Ings is playing. It's through his help that he's got back in the England squad. And I really hope Che Adams kicks on this season because he did struggle before. So he's maybe looking like the Premier League player people thought he was going to be when he was at Birmingham.
Man City 1, Arsenal 0. A lot was made of the tactical battle between Guardiola and Arteta and the systems. Johnny Liu writing, in the end, this was not really a game won and lost on plans or schemes. City won because they had better players who'd been coached together for longer. Sometimes it really is that simple. Is it that simple, Andy?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't see all of the game, I've got to be honest. But yeah, I think Jonathan makes a very pertinent point. Arsenal, for all the strides they've made under Arteta, it's early days. City are much further down the line in their work under their manager. So what I did see of the game, I think it was good. It was a proper game between two really good teams, well-coached teams. I think Arsenal are clearly getting there. And the fact that they're disappointed to lose 1-0 at City, is another indication of which way they're going.
I've seen some people, Natasha, criticising Arteta for sort of playing Willian down the middle. I don't know what you thought about that because, Aubameyang does like to come off the left, doesn't he? Pepe does like to come off the right.
Yeah, I think that's an at-the-moment situation. I think once Partey's game fit, that will change. I think he's put him there for his experience and his game knowledge as opposed to maybe for what he can do for the team in the long term of the game. But I expect that over the next month, I expect that to change. I don't expect Willian to be down the middle, say, at the start of December.
Can we talk about Sergio Aguero and Sean Macielis? There was a disagreement over a throw-in, and Aguero put his arm sort of on the neck of Sean Macielis, and it looked pretty awkward. Michael Richards said he should know better. The Labour MP, Dr. Rosanna Alan Khan, was critical, saying, "Who does Aguero think he is? Completely unacceptable." Pep Guardiola, meanwhile, said Sergio is the nicest person I ever met in my life, which is quite the accolade. He'll face no action. The rules state that touching an official is not an offence unless it's done in an aggressive or threatening manner. It's understood that the PGMOL does not view Aguero's action as falling into either of those categories. I showed it to my wife because I was sort of interested to see what somebody who has no interest in the game thinks. And she obviously has no idea who Sean Macielis or Sergio Aguero is. And she said it did look patronising. Her question was, you know, would he have done that to a male official?
He has done it to several male officials.
I think there's a slight difference. He didn't put his hand on her neck. He pulled her to, he tried to pull her into his direction. I think firstly, she's an official. She's doing her job. No official should be having hands put on them. But I think for me, even if he didn't mean it aggressively, it's how it's received by the other person. You know, when people say, oh, it's banter, but if someone doesn't take it that way, then it stops being banter. So if I know me personally, I don't speak for Sean Macielis, but I know me personally, if someone did that to me, I would instinctively feel defensive. I think part of why people are saying it's okay is because Aguero is not physically threatening. He's a similar height and size to Sean Macielis. If that was someone like Virgil van Dijk, who's a good 6 foot odd, I think it would look very different. And I think a lot of people would have a different opinion on it.
It's inexcusable. He shouldn't have done it, and he should probably apologise. Although if he apologises now, 2 days after the event, it will be dismissed as a PR move or whatever. The one thing I would say is that, looking at it again, I think he said something, because if you look at her left arm, she sort of gives a, oh, it's okay gesture, and she goes on and he goes back on the field. If she had wanted to make an issue of it, he would have been sent off and he could have no complaints. But it doesn't make him a terrible person, but he absolutely should not have done it.
I thought she was more brushing him off. I mean, you know, like, you know, what are you doing? Get off. And I agree with your Mrs. Max. I think it was patronizing.
Yeah. I mean, don't touch women you don't really know.
Yeah.
You know, people saying, oh, you know, women want equality. So, you know, he's touched a male official. So he's touched a female official. This is equality. I mean, that I don't buy that at all. I think there is a difference between a man touching a woman like that.
I think you're completely right. I mean, I think a lot of guys are underestimating how a male who is not someone you know touching you can feel physically threatening. I'm not saying she felt threatened. I'm just saying, as a whole, someone you don't know grabbing your wrist, grabbing your shoulder or your neck, instinctively you react to that, and it's unsettling. When I saw it, I felt uncomfortable. I really did. I probably would have turned around and had a few more words with him than she did, because there was just no need for it. There's no need to touch anyone. And the irony is, footballers are the first ones to get angry when another player touches them. So they should have that same respect for everyone else that's in the football pitch with them.
At Newcastle United 1, Manchester United 4. Lots of late goals for Manchester United, but they deserved their victory, Andy.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Especially the way they fell behind as well, given, you know, where they were at coming into the game, and to go behind to another quality own goal. It could quite easily have been, oh, here we go. But to be fair to him, Harry Maguire, he's been mentioned a lot recently, negatively. So I think, you know, he deserves a bit of credit himself for, you know, performing as he should, and, you know, getting his team back in it. And yeah, some quality finishes at the end. I loved the you know, the little release from Rashford to Fernandes for his thing, because, especially with his goal being disallowed as well, which was an outstanding goal that could have added to the whole you know, malaise around Manchester United at the minute. But to be fair to them, they didn't let it get to them, and they produced, you know, a great finish, brilliant finish.
Juan Mata made a bit of a difference, Baz, didn't he?
Yeah, he was outstanding. He had him and Bruno Fernandes seemed to have a great, almost telepathic understanding, and caused Newcastle all sorts of problems.
It's a weird thing about this season. I'm not necessarily including Manchester United, Natasha, in the title race conversation, but it's hard to know who to include or how far it goes down. And you know, especially with this Van Dijk injury to Liverpool, you sort of feel you could get a bit of a random winner this season.
I agree. And I love it. I love the randomness of not seeing two teams at the top and knowing it's going to be City or Liverpool. And I think given all the madness that's going on in the world, I think an interesting football, an interesting Premier League season is exactly what we all need right now.
Palace won, Brighton won. The M23 derby, or as Kevin Day, Palace fan, likes to point out, it's the A222, A232, A23, M23, A27 derby. Palace had one shot to Brighton's 17, and Alexis McAllister equalised in the last minute. He is Argentinian, if you didn't know. And his older brothers are professional footballers. They're the sons of a professional footballer and nephews of professional footballers of Irish and Scottish descent. I have a feeling Wilson has told us about the migration of Scots to Argentina back at some point on this podcast, but it was quite a long sentence. And with most of Wilson's long sentences, I fell asleep during it. What did you make of this game, Andy?
Well, I still don't think that excuses the space between the Mac and the Alistair.
Yes.
I'm not happy with that. Yeah, no, it was a fair play to Brighton as well, because I mean Palace have been doing well, and to, you know, they dominated that second half. Although that Lewis Dunk foul, another scissor. What was he doing? I mean, honest to God, Cahill was really lucky there that he didn't end up with it in a Van Dijk situation. And you just wonder what goes through some players' heads sometimes. And there was some like kind of excuse making for him. In the time that it happened, which is just ridiculous. But yeah, no, a really good performance by Brighton. I love Lamptey. I think he's great. I could watch him every week. I think he's brilliant. One, even a right back that you're drawn to constantly. I love watching him play.
And that means we could put Trent Alexander into midfield, which for some reason everybody wants to do.
He might be at centre-half soon.
Yeah, probably. Sheffield United won, Fulham won. Dan says, does anyone know if Sheffield United Fulham actually happened? Does anyone think that the two teams just decided to call it 1-1 and not bother to get togged out, knowing full well nobody would pay the $14.95 for it? We know it happened, Natasha, because you went there, unless you're part of the conspiracy.
No. I did go. Do you know what? If you paid the £15, good luck to you, because it wasn't the best game. But I think it was a 1-1 draw was great for both teams. I found out that Chris Wilder is really, really vocal on the touchline. You know, in an empty stadium, you can really hear him above all else. Mitrovic loves to curse at himself in Serbian after he misses his third shot of the day. But I think Fulham will come away from that with a lot of confidence. The new signings, Ruben Loftus-Cheek, Tosin in defence, Ademola Lookman, who scored the goal, even the goalkeeper, Areola. I mean, I cover Fulham a lot, and I actually watched them and felt confident that they could now start to pick up results, because the areas where they needed to strengthen, they had, and they brought in players who actually look like they know what they're doing. I think Ruben Loftus-Cheek is going to be great for them, and I think Lookman has a lot to prove in the Premier League. He's clearly enthusiastic. He has a lot of talent, and Scott Parker is probably the best-dressed manager of the generation. Yeah, that's about it.
Do you have faith that Fulham can sort of kick on, as in get more than 11 points and not be worse than Derby County, or kick on and survive?
More than 11 points. I'm not going to put my head on the chopping block like that, but yeah, more than 11 points.
Natasha, can you give us an exact number of points? You cover Fulham a lot. How many points exactly do you think they'll get?
Okay, 30.
30?
Yeah.
30 points?
30 points.
Natasha Henry scale. Perfect.
I'd imagine, Natasha, there was a lot of Serbian profanity in the night air yesterday, because Mitrovic really had a bad day at the office, didn't he?
Yeah, I mean, like Scott Parker said, he had a really bad day, but there's been times where he's been the only person on that team that's been able to get them a result. I mean, his penalty hit the top of the crossbar, went into the empty stands. He headed wide, he shot wide, he gave away a penalty. It was literally, he would have gone home, put on some headphones, wrapped himself in a warm quilt and had a hot chocolate and probably cried himself to sleep. It was that bad.
I think he would have gone full Ketz Buyer. I don't think his house exists anymore. I think he's just kicked it down, personally. Anyway, that'll do for part two. Part three, we'll get Ewan Murray on and do an extended Fit Bar Corner. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Barca Jim says, can Barry bin off Fitbar Corner this week? He's a Celtic fan. Francisco, a Rangers fan, says, extended Fitbar Corner, please. Let's bring in Ewan Murray and make it a proper Fitbar Corner. How are you, Ewan?
That mean, has it been binned off because I've arrived? Is that what we've done?
Yeah. Thanks for your time and good night. Celtic 0, Rangers 2. Connor Goldson, the unlikely hero. Was it an easy victory? Did they deserve it?
Oh, very much so, yeah. I mean, I think we had this conversation at the end of last December when Rangers won. It was 2-1 that day, but they were equally comfortable at Celtic Park, so it was very similar. They deserved to win. They won with a bit to spare, and Celtic didn't lay a glove on Rangers, really, throughout the game. And considering they were the home team and defending champions, domestic dominance, blah, 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 that was quite surprising to some people. Although not a lot of their own supporters, who have been kind of mumping and moaning through the course of this season, and I think quite a few people saw this result coming.
So is this finally the turn? You know, is this seeing the scales tipping towards Steven Gerrard's men? Yeah,
this is obviously not a straightforward debate. The first thing to say is Celtic were missing key players. They were missing Odson Edouard, who's the best player in the country. I would argue they missed Ryan Christie, they missed James Forrest, they missed Christopher Julien. You know, it would be silly to ignore that as a reference point and a mitigating circumstance. And we also have to say that, you know, Rangers have been, you know, including last December, they've won at Celtic Park and looked in a strong position in the league, and then they've capitulated. So, you know, I think it would be unwise to give hard and fast assessments based on that game. But, you know, the Rangers team that won didn't have any Old Firm debutants. Celtic had 8. There is a sense that you know, Rangers just now are more settled. And Celtic are, I don't want to say disorganised, but they're not as, things are changing and moving, and they haven't had the kind of calmness that they've been used to in a domestic setting. And my theory always is that the rest of the Scottish Premier League isn't particularly strong, so Rangers shouldn't really drop many points elsewhere if they do their job. So when they get victories such as the one on Saturday, that should be significant. But as I say, they have previous for throwing it away. Maybe the fact they've got previous for throwing it away means they won't do it this time, but it's going to be fascinating over the next few months.
You and Lawrence Donegan, your friend of mine, formerly this parish, seem to lay the blame squarely at the door of Neil Lennon, and he's not the only one I've seen saying that Lennon shouldn't be in that job. How much credit does Gerrard deserve, and how much opprobrium, I suppose, does Neil Lennon get?
Yeah, the Lennon situation is fascinating. I mean, Celtic got bundled out of the Champions League by Ferencvaros earlier in the season, and I was quite taken aback at the level of kind of vitriol towards him at that point. And I felt up until Saturday, Celtic actually hadn't played very well for a few weeks. As I said, there was this kind of undercurrent of dissatisfaction towards him. And Lawrence is a good example. I mean, it blew up a lot on Saturday. Now, I've got a theory that people who are associated with clubs long term, you know, their own people, get this harder than outsiders, if you know what I mean, if that makes sense. If Neil was someone from out with Celtic, dare I say a foreign manager, they wouldn't quite get the vitriol that their own people tend to get. Now, of course, he's not blameless. I think he was too slow in changing things on Saturday when it clearly wasn't working. They played the same system for 84 minutes, and as I said, didn't lay a glove on Rangers. But he had these mitigating factors of the players that were missing. And in fairness, you know, just go back to January, Celtic have got previous for turning this around. And of course, Gerrard's due credit, because I think Rangers have improved. I mean, myself and others have given him enough criticism because he's had 2 seasons in charge and hasn't won a thing. So when it seems that things are picking up, and Rangers looked on Saturday, not for the first time against Celtic, like a very well-coached and well-drilled team. So of course, just as Neil Lennon can't escape blame, Steven Gerrard's due a lot of praise and credit for how well his team played.
Below the Premiership, Ewan, the Scottish League started on Friday, but why exactly was that? And there's lots of talk of like the big picture here in England, you know, of money going from the top and filtering down and bailouts. Obviously, there isn't as much money at the top of the Scottish game, but is there any sort of conversation along the same lines?
Don't be silly, no. I thought you were speaking about that so we can speak about Hearts' glorious 6-2 win against Dundee on Friday night to kick off their season. No, what's happened there is, I mean, they're playing an abbreviated 27-game season. And I think what concerns me is there's no rules and legislation in place for what happens if it's cut short. These teams aren't subject to testing. In terms of distributing money differently, no, that's never been a serious conversation and never will be. The Premiership teams would have you believe that it's all part of the, you know, the greater good is how they work, etc., etc. But no, it's very much weighted in favour of getting the Premiership done this season is, you know, somehow in some way get the Premiership done and the rest can just fall into line. So, I mean, I still have real concerns about how the Scottish season is going to play out, to be honest.
Finally, though, in international terms, Steve Clarke is getting some results for Scotland. How much enthusiasm is there ahead of that playoff?
There is enthusiasm at last. I mean, I don't know how much you saw of it, but the game against the Czech Republic last week, Scotland were a bit lucky to win, but it was a terrific game. They are 8 games unbeaten. And Steve Clarke, you know, I quite admire Steve Clarke's old-fashioned pragmatism. You know, he doesn't stand on ceremony. He doesn't really bow to public pressure or opinion. He does what he thinks right. He doesn't want validation or vindication from outside. And suddenly Scotland are going to Serbia with a bit of hope and confidence that they can win that and get to the Euros. Although, Lincoln, I'm also concerned that, I mean, what form are the Euros going to take? How are the Euros going to happen next summer in multiple cities and whatever else? It would just be Scotland's thing to qualify for a tournament that is so disrupted or cannot happen. So,
thanks for coming on, Ewan, as always.
Thank you. See you soon. All the best.
Ewan Murray, our Scottish football correspondent there. Wayne Rooney elsewhere is reportedly seething after a visit from a friend who later tested positive for COVID. The Sun newspaper reported that friend and entrepreneur Josh Bardsley visited him on Thursday to give him a watch. The paper said he'd taken a test, Bardsley, and should therefore have been self-isolating. His test later came back positive. Rooney said he didn't know and played in Derby's 1-0 home defeat to Watford on Friday evening. A day after the visit, a statement from Rooney's management. He's angry and disappointed that he, his family and his club have been put in this position by someone acting secretly and in breach of government and NHS guidelines. Likely the Derby and Watford squads, along with their support staff, will be forced to take tests. I guess it does raise some interesting questions about what responsibility players and staff have for people who are coming to visit them. Also raises the key question about how badly you need a watch, Barry.
Well, yeah, it's a fascinating story. Why was he delivering a watch? How desperately did Wayne need the watch? I don't think it was any old watch. Apparently it was a luxury timepiece. I've never understood why people spend loads of money on watches, mainly because I can't really look after them and constantly break them. My current watch I've had since 2017, which is a record by about 2 years, but it's a big chunky plastic digital one I bought in Australia. But yeah, a lot to unpick from that story, but I can understand why Rooney's annoyed. I don't know what ramifications it'll have for the players of and staff of Derby County and Watford, but yeah, but it was irresponsible of the young entrepreneur Josh.
It was, but at least Wayne Rooney knows what the time is.
Yes.
We should note that Cambridge United are top of the league, won 5-0 at Scunthorpe. I don't know what's happening, and I don't want to talk about it in case I jinx it. Barca and Real both lost. We'll get Sid on this week, one of our Champions League pods. We should congratulate Viviana Miedemar as well. Has become the Women's Super League's record goal scorer. She's an absolutely glorious footballer. And Joe Montemurro said her contract is top of the list and the club will do everything we can to make sure Viv remains part of the group at Arsenal. All right, that'll do for today. We're not doing a pod on Tuesday. We're going to wait for the Champions League games on Tuesday night. So we'll do one Wednesday and one Thursday. So we'll see you then in the meantime. Natasha, thank you for your time.
Thank you so much, guys.
Cheers, Andy.
Thanks for having me. Thank you.
Cheers, Baz.
Cheers.
Back on Wednesday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.